The Guardian.
Hello, this is Music Weekly, and as you might have guessed, I'm not Alexis Petridis. Instead, you're stuck with me, Tim Jones, standing in manfully while Alexis is away, scouring the outskirts of Siberia for signs of a handbag house revival. Well, either that or he's moving house. But don't despair, for there's more to this instalment of Music Weekly than simply barbed comments. On the show this week, we have a chat with legendary music journalist Nick Kent, an expert's view on the latest developments in bass, and of course, Singles Club, with new music from Maria Minerva, Holy Ghost, and George Sule. That's all to come on Music Weekly. Joining me in the pod today to discuss these songs and other matters are Barney Hoskins, veteran of the music journal Game and curator of the excellent site Rocks Back Pages. Hello, Barney.
Hi, Tim.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
What have you been up to in the last few days?
Well, I've actually just been doing rather boring things to do with Rocks Back Pages.
Surely nothing boring with Rocks Back Pages.
No, but the behind-the-scenes stuff can be slightly boring. I mean, we're celebrating 10 years in business this month, so there's just various things going on that I'm having to deal with. For example, we are sponsoring the award to Nick Kent next week at the Record of the Day Awards. So, yeah, my last few days have really been taken up with kind of logistics. Nick is staying with me tonight and Wednesday. So it's that sort of thing that's been going on.
Well, also here, it's not just Barney, it's Sian Rowe, queen of the music blogging scene, making her pod debut, I think. Sian is a writer for the likes of Dazed and Confused and The Guardian. How are you, Sian?
I'm fine, thank you, Tim. Thanks for calling me queen of the music blogs. I've never been a queen of anything before, so that's a first.
Do you think that's an honour? Do you feel...
I feel really special now.
And what have you been up to the last few days?
I have been watching some new bands and some
watching
bands that have been around.
Like
watching
proper, new bands. Like a proper music journalist.
Yes, you could say that, yes. I saw King Cruel on Tuesday at Corsica Studios, which was completely packed.
One of the big tops for 2012.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's kind of funny, this kind of huge room of people staring at a skinny ginger kid in a baseball cap.
He does look good.
Yeah.
He looks like a proper pop star.
So he does. Yeah, some rappers in the house as well. Jay Electronica was there, which was interesting to see. And then I went to see a band called The Babies in Brixton on Wednesday, and they were good, over from America, for the third time this year, I think. So I've seen those a few times, and that was good as well.
It's time for us to have a chat with a bona fide music journo legend. I am, of course, talking about Nick Kent, who many of you will know as one of the leading lights of the 70s rock writer generation. Interviewing the likes of Iggy Pop, Keith Richards and Led Zeppelin, often maintaining a rock and roll lifestyle that matched his subjects. He collected his best works in famous rock tome The Dark Stuff, and last year released his 70s memoir Apathy for the Devil. He's also about to receive an outstanding contribution to journalism award at the Record of the Day Awards in London next week, so we sent our reporter John Dennis off to Paris, where Kent now lives, for a catch-up.
I think we got like £2 a month or something. But then all of a sudden I discovered that, wow, you know, free records. The whole idea of free records had never occurred to me. I thought reviewers went out and bought the records. I thought John Peel went out and bought the records that he played on the radio.
Nothing makes it move from the bottom to the top. Does it start at the bottom? Or does it start at the top?
From dark. Sends him a spark. Sends him a spark.
And it was only, what, about a year before you found yourself working for NME. How did that begin?
No, it was less than that. It was less than that. It happened for me very, very, very quickly. What happened was I became the music editor of the Friends, like, boom, like that. And I wanted to write articles instead of just reviews. And we're talking about the underground press. The underground press was mostly fixated on political and sociological rebellion. And they needed music journalism to actually get people to buy it. And so I was a kind of a fairly valuable addition to the whatever staff they had. The 6 months when I was working for the underground press was some of the best times I had, because that was when I met the Stooges. That was when I met and spent time with the MC5. That was when I travelled around England with Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band, who were then at their absolute top peak of their game. That was when I went on tour with the Grateful Dead. I mean, going on tour, not just sitting in a room doing interviews. I mean, getting on a bus and going from gig to gig and standing at the side of the stage and seeing how it was done and talking and being part of the entourage for several days.
Which, when you're 21, is nothing more exciting than
20,
that.
Yeah, I was 20. I just turned 20 at the time. So it was, yeah, it was thrilling. I was a huge fan of Captain Beefheart's Magic Band, and to see how they worked was just one of the most thrilling things that I've ever experienced. It was a great time because it hadn't got really big. Sansom's Park, Sansom's
Park. And it was you pursued Bowie for some time without success, but you did manage to meet, as you say, you got to know the Stooges a bit and the Iggy Pop, and it was the fact that you'd managed to sort of get in with them that helped you get a job at NME, wasn't it?
I think they would have picked me, Iggy Pop and the Stooges were not a big name then. They knew that I was seeing this guy, and he was otherwise unavailable to the press, and used that as a sort of introduction to get me to write for the paper. But I think they would have picked some other topic, they would have found someone else for me to write. They wanted me, you know. Now
NME was in quite a difficult state at the point you joined them, weren't they? They'd only given a few months to justify their existence.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, I've told this story before, but in April of 1972, the NME was selling 60,000 copies, whereas the Melody Maker was probably about, getting on for 200,000 copies, and it was close to becoming extinct. And what IPC, which owned both the NME and the Melody Maker, did was say to the NME, listen, what we're going to do is we're going to give you a special promotion thing, and we're going to put money into the publicity for you. But what you have to do is you have to completely change the paper, change the way it's being written, change the subject matter, or else we're going to take you off the market in 12 issues.
What did they come up with?
Well, they got Charles Sean Murray, first of all, and about a month later, they got me and a fellow called Ian McDonald. They also changed... the NME had been a very unconvincing fusion of kind of Top of the Pops and the underground prog rock thing that was happening, which Melody Maker did so much better. As I was saying, 60,000 readers in April. By December of that year, almost 200,000 readers. And Nick Logan, I remember Nick Logan in December taking me, I was there. Anyway, he called me in and he said that because there'd been this steep acceleration in sales, IPC had done a survey. And what they discovered from this was that, because I was thinking, well, he's going to say it's all because of me and Murray and McDonald. It wasn't anything to do with that. It was to do with the fact that they bought the paper to look at the photographs.
Must have been chastening.
That was the main thing. And the only thing they read religiously every week was the gossip column in the last but one page. Okay. So once I dusted my wounded ego off the floor, I mean, I immediately sort of looked at the situation I was in and realized that I and everyone else on the paper was dealing with a massively short attention span driven audience, and that the only way to get their attention was to do outrageous things, to write in a more outrageous way, to be in a more flamboyant, and just don't ignore me. You're buying the paper, you're looking at the pictures, okay, now read the bloody text.
And tell us about the influence of Lester Bangs, the American music journalist. How did he influence you? And did you sort of went to him for asking for help to help you fulfill your potential? Did he help? How did he help you do that?
Well, the thing that really stuck with me was his belief that the really interesting stories in music were the stories of people that were losers. It wasn't the winners. It wasn't Paul McCartney who was interesting, because Paul McCartney is just a guy that's won over and over again. He won with the Beatles, He was a big success. He's had success after success after success. And though we all love Paul McCartney and I have huge respect for the man, he is also a very bland subject to write about, I think most people will agree. The people that are the losers are the ones, you know, had the talent but they didn't have the self-discipline or they didn't have the central nervous system.
You wrote a celebrated article, for instance, about Sid Barrett in the 70s.
Yeah, well, poor old Sid, he didn't have the central nervous system to be a professional rock musician going touring around and around.
You mount an interesting defence in your book, Apathy for the Devil, of Mick Jagger along these lines. You know, you quote him as saying something like, you know, it's very hard work being me. And so a lot of the things that she's criticised for, you kind of find an explanation for that being Mick Jagger.
Because it infuriates me. Everybody would seem to think that because I write about people that are self-destructive and have had troubled careers, that I empathise with these people. I can in a way, but I have far more respect for people who survive and thrive. But as long as they do it in an honourable way. If Keith Richards was the leader of the Rolling Stones in all facets of their organisation as well as their music, then the Rolling Stones would be like the Pretty Things. They'd be as big as the Pretty Things. They'd be playing to audiences of no more than 2,000 people a night. When the Rolling Stones go out to play, they play to 50,000, 70,000 people a night. That's the difference. Mick Jagger understands the big picture. And he also understands that what you have to do to go on stage and still get those bums on seats. Mick Jagger gets a bad rap in the press because he is not an easy person to interview. Whereas Keith Richards is the complete opposite. Keith Richards recognises, very, very canny, that he recognises that he's got this wild image and that people are going to be frightened of him. First-time interviewers are going to be a bit frightened of him. So he's very charming. It's his shtick. Mick Jagger just can't be bothered because Mick Jagger, at the end of the day, doesn't want your love. He doesn't want the love of his audience. He ain't fucking Judy Garland. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that I respect, that I have respect for. He wants your money, yeah, okay. And so does everybody else. Every other performer wants your money, man. But what he's prepared to do to get that money is to make sure that the group he's working with is at the top of its game. The Rolling Stones, when they performed over the last 20 years, have been a lot better than they were back in the 70s.
Ah, well, that was rock critic and former Enemy bad boy Nick Kentner talking to The Guardian's John Dennis. Barney, let me turn to you as a curator of a whole host of great music writing on Rock's Back Pages, some of which we're showcasing on our site, I should add. I assume you're a fan of Kent's writing. What is it about him that made him so special, do you think?
Well, Kent looked like a rock star and behaved like a rock star. And
all leather trousers and all that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Nick Kent aesthetic lies behind so much of what we now sort of revere in terms of, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll, that lifestyle. He's sort of in, well, he didn't invent it, but he captured it. He was the backstage access to that, Tim, really. So for me, growing up, I mean, you know, I 70s was sort of my era in terms of being a teenager. So discovering and reading Nick Kent in the New Musical Express, I mean, that was my window into that world. It was, you did feel like you were there backstage with Keith Richards or Iggy Pop or Jimmy Page or whoever it might be. You know, Nick emulated that lifestyle in ways that were not necessarily conducive to good health, but he certainly captured it and made you aspire to it. But he also didn't just write about the Bad Boys. I mean, there's a famous three-part epic in NME on Brian Wilson, the whole saga, the sort of tragedy of the Beach Boys. And I think Brian Wilson said at the time when he was being interviewed by Nick, he said, maybe I should interview you. You look more like a rock star than I do. Not difficult, given, you know, Brian Wilson's never really looked like a rock star. In fact, he's not a rock star. But anyway, so that's what Nick Kemp was about. That was his golden decade. So, but he's gone on to write, you know, great things in subsequent eras.
So take drugs and wear skinny trousers, kind of the first tip to becoming a great writer.
They're relatively simple steps to take, Tim. You know, everything else follows from there.
I mean, he talked about trying to make his writing as exciting on the page as the records he was listening to were to kind of put on your stereo. Is that something you think is other journalists have taken up that mantle?
I mean, I think that's the business of criticism, isn't it? To invoke what you're hearing, but also to give a sense of the context of the creation of the music, of the socio-cultural kind of ramifications of the music. I think there's various ways of writing about music, but I think the best writers do get into the kind of tissue of the music itself and bring that alive, make that happen on the page.
As an NME writer, or a former NME writer myself, those kind of the likes of Charles Shaw Murray, Julie Birchall and Nick Kent were always like the big shadow in the background of these kind of the golden era of the magazine, which we could never emulate. I mean, I was going to turn to you, Sean, and kind of say, are these people like part of what your generation, are they heroes for you?
Not so much, mainly because I wasn't really exposed to them. It's probably now that I'm kind of first starting to hear about them, really. When I was growing up, the people at NME were was you, Tim. So you know, talking about the Cribs. So it was definitely really different. didn't you have a message board dedicated to you, though?
We did have a forum dedicated to Slash Fiction about us.
There we go.
There was kind of young writers writing kind of gay porn about me and Barry Nicholson, which, you know.
So you were still rock and roll. There we go.
Exactly. I think I was carrying on the flame, Nick Kent's flame, really. Let's carry on talking about kind of journalism. With your site, Barney Rocks Back Pages, 10 years, it's been going for 10 years. How did it first come into existence? What was the kind of the thought process behind setting it up?
The germ of it was simply, I came back from America after nearly 4 years as Mojo's US guy. I came back to London and it was the sort of dot era of the dot-com madness, and it just so happened that a press officer called me up and said, I want someone to do some Roy Harper sleeve notes, and do you know who that person might be? So I just suddenly had this kind of vision of, you know, a kind of archive of articles on Roy Harper. You know, you could go online and there would be the 50 best pieces ever written on Roy Harper. So that was sort of it. And I thought, well, that'd be quite a good thing to attempt to do anyway. And it just sort of snowballed from there. And we got a number of writers on board. So, and we launched in 2001 with maybe about 30 writers.
Okay, and that's how you negotiate the rights, because they own their rights, which is something that a lot of younger journalists don't do anymore.
Well, there we're getting into a very, you know, thorny area, of course. That whole, yeah, but there was the opportunity there, in a sense, to sneak in through the back door, go to writers that I knew, and not necessarily writers I even knew, but I was able to reach out to that kind of community, and most of them had done the majority of their writing as freelancers. So yeah, they own the copyright in their work.
Do you feel like the respect for great music writing has diminished in recent years, especially with kind of the internet age, everyone just either copying and pasting things or just writing little pithy things about MP3s? Do you feel like this art form has been lost?
I think that what's been lost, and I think you can argue there's a diminishing respect for the written word per se, right across the board. But I think that you really go from a time when, you know, everybody read The Enemy. Anyone was serious about music, was avid about music, read The Enemy. And therefore, you had sort of singular voices in that magazine. We don't need to debate when the golden era began ended.
2003 to 2006, I always like to think of the...
I'm sure you're right. I shall go and investigate. But, you know, there were these voices, you know, the obvious names kind of rear their heads, the late Lester Bangs, Nick Kent, Charles Sean Murray, Ian McDonald. I mean, I have a lot of favourite writers who I think were genuinely good writers, you know, and you followed their byline. And I think something turned around over the course of the 1980s. So you still had these mad egomaniacs at the beginning of that decade. By the end, I think it sort of turned around a bit. And I think by the 90s, you know, music criticism, music journalism had become more kind of subservient. It had become more of a service industry. And I think we're now in a world where a lot of music journalism, certainly kind of the broadsheets and monthlies and so forth, is simply about these are the records you need to buy this month. You know, it's more like just kowtowing to a kind of to a consumer lifestyle.
Sian, is that something you agree with? Do you feel like music journalism lost its edge somewhat?
Yes and no, although I wasn't alive then in the 70s and 80s, so I don't really know.
Wasn't alive in the 80s.
Like. I was first alive in 1988, and I've been alive ever since. Do you think maybe... I was wondering, do you think maybe, though, that music has changed? It's not just music journalism that has changed, because now, if you look, the artists that were being covered in the 70s, music journalists were the people who had access to them. Whereas now, I can find out what a lot of artists are doing every minute of the day. I can find out what they eat. I can find out, you know, I don't think many of
them...
The mystery has kind of disappeared.
Which is why you get all these bands, I guess, who kind of won't reveal their names or won't reveal what they look like and all that. It's just a way of trying to create some kind of mystery before someone goes on Twitter and says, I've just seen him having a Greg's pasty backstage.
Yeah, but I think there's also for the writers as well. I think there's definitely less mystery. You can search someone's name and you can find out so much about them that you don't. There's not that same cult of personality, I don't think, that you got with writers. Obviously, when I was younger, I read just music magazines. I got a year of Melody Maker in, always got The Enemy, and then there was magazines like Plan B. That definitely had more of a kind of personality to it, and I really loved that magazine. But obviously now, that's folded as well, although you can still read them all online, I think.
One thing definitely in kind of praise of modern music journalism and your kind of blogging culture, I would say, though, is there's this kind of quote from Nick Kent where he's talking about how exciting it was to be writing and then 3 days later to see it on the newsstands. Obviously now it's 2 minutes later you can have it published and people talking about it and you get access to that discussion. I mean, do you find that thrilling?
How would you
feel if one of your pieces went online and there was no debate, no debate, no discussion?
That's great. You can get the debate straight away. Sometimes it's not, you know, so complimentary.
Sometimes. Yeah. Very rarely. Very rarely are people on the internet rude.
No, never. But no, that's exciting. And also just seeing artists as well. So if there's a track that no one's ever heard before and you put it online and loads of people start talking about it and sharing it, it's quite nice to see. We had a track by an artist called The Shining, and it's only on a YouTube rip. It's not anywhere else, but people are kind of sharing that and talking about it. And it's this guy called Morgan Cerati and this producer called Asid. They normally do kind of very like clever dance music, and this is definitely more hooky and more poppy. And, you know, that went down really well. So it's really great to kind of see that. But it's less, they're very, like, hard, no, people don't know much about them. But it's still exciting.
How long do you think that will last? Not very long, I'd imagine.
I'd say a while.
Well, on the subject of music writing, I should probably plug some of the best music writing we've ever had on our site. I'm talking about the My Favourite Album series, in which our writers surprisingly wrote about their favourite album. Who would have guessed? It seemed to combine memoir with music writing and is now all available as an ebook at a ridiculously cheap cost of somewhere around £1. Sian, you wrote one of her favourite albums. What was yours?
I wrote about PJ Harvey's Try.
Oh, you did indeed. I wrote about Hidden Cameras, which is probably no one else's favourite album, but I love it dearly. Did you see any of that writing, Barney?
I didn't, no. Tell me more of the albums that were...
Some of the best ones, amazingly, weren't by music writers. That was kind of what came to it for me. It was like... the music writers wanted to write about how important a record was and write about the music, whereas the best ones like Simon Hattenstern or Hadley Freeman were just talking about what the album meant to them growing up. Simon wrote about how he was basically on a sick bed and Dark Side of the Moon was the only thing that could kind of he could relate to, and it brought him and his dad back together as friends because they'd fallen out, and all they'd do is lie on beds together with Dark Side of the Moon on. So, you know, a really kind of beautiful piece. What's your favourite album?
My favourite album? Well, of all time, it is has to be A Wizard of True Star by Todd Harry Rundgren.
I have not heard that record. Are you shocked and appalled?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is, to me, it's up there. It's up there with, you know, with Pet Sounds and Forever okay. Changes and Dry and... Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary.
That's
it's an extraordinary
in the canon, is it?
Journey of, through sound. It's a remarkable okay. record.
Well, the My Favourite Album series is now available as an ebook at a ridiculously cheap cost of somewhere around an English pound. It comes with pictures too and a little intro from me. Well, that was a fun trek through music journalism's past, but now it's time once more to gaze, as we like to do, into pop's bright future. So let me offer you the following phrases. Bass! How low can you go? Bass in the place, London. Watch your bass bins, I'm telling you. Yes, these are all sentences that involve the word bass. They are also the basis of a terrible podcast link into a feature on bass. So what exactly is the state of bass in 2011? What bass music should we be listening to right now? And will said listening rupture our bowels? Clearly, it was time for us to send a resident expert to explain the ins and outs of bass, and we found one in the shape of Sam Richards.
My name's Sam Richards from The Guardian Guide, and I'm here to talk about bass music. That is, the sounds thumping out of discerning club sound systems, souped-up car stereos and oversized headphones across London and beyond. First up is a new track from Brixton DJ, producer and talented women's footballer Coolie G. I'm expecting great things from her debut album, which is due out early next year on Hyperdub. This particular track is a collaboration with Baltimore house producer Charisma. The title is It's Serious. If you enjoyed that, Coolie G is DJing this Friday the 18th at Corsica Studios in London alongside UK garage legends MJ Cole and Wookie, and also a live set from the excellent Bass Clef. Next up, here's something new from Bok Bok, which is the pleasingly percussive pseudonym for a savvy young chap called Alex Souchon. He's the co-founder of the Night Slugs empire. Not only do Night Slugs put on some of the best parties around, they also have a hugely influential record label that's put out landmark bass releases from the likes of Jam City and Girl Unit. This is something a bit different from Bok Bok's usual output. It's a collaboration with Dutch house DJ Tom Trago, although Bok Bok's rhyme origins still seep through, I think. The EP is called Night Voyage Toolkit, and this track is called Vector. If you're into that, Bok Bok also does a weekly show on Rinse FM where you can catch more of his new productions. Alright, another collaboration, this time between dubstep stalwarts Pinch and Shackleton. Pinch is basically Bristol's dubstep kingpin, having launched his Subloaded Night back in 2004. He also runs the influential label Tectonic. Shackleton is one of the producers who first started joining the dots between UK dubstep and Berlin dub techno with his weighty productions, and now he lives in the German capital full-time. But both of Pinch and Shackleton have got together for this collaborative release. The artists both renowned for their stern aesthetic productions, but their music is still very physical, as you'll hear from this track, which is called Burning Blood. That was Pinch and Shackleton there, and their album is out now on Honest John's. And finally, one of my personal albums of the year is released this week in the form of Sepulchre's self-titled debut. Sepulchre are two guys from Brooklyn, Praveen Sharma and Travis Stewart. Travis Stewart also put out a great album earlier this year on Planet Moo under the name Machine Drum. Anyway, Sepulchre's music reminds me a little bit of Burial in the way that's ridden with echoes of dance music past, all those disembodied divas and evocative synth chords. But Sepulchre's music isn't so eerie or atmospheric. It's actually pretty lush and warm and uplifting. As you'll hear from this track, which is from the album, as I said, called Sepulchre, the track is also a single. It's called Pencil Pimp. Sepulchre are also playing live if you're out and about in London on Friday the 18th. They launched their album alongside a bunch of mates from the excellent Hot Flush label at the Question Mark Bar in Stoke Newington. And even if you can't make it out to hear this music in a club environment, hopefully these tracks have encouraged you to get a bit of bass in your life. That's me done. Thanks for listening.
Well, that was Sam Richards telling you everything you needed to know and possibly a few things you will never need to know about bass. And now it is basically time for Singles Club. Sean and Barney, strap yourselves in as we wrap our critical ears around three new releases. Let's start with Gloria by Maria Minerva, which is Sean's choice. That was Maria Minerva with Gloria. Maria is a 23-year-old Estonian, purveyor of ghostly disco, whose career has thus far involved interning at the Wire magazine, it's a real music journal special this week, as well as attending Goldsmith College and releasing records on hip LA label Not Not Fun. Sean, tell us why you like this track.
Well, the first time I heard Maria Minerva, I was told not to like her because she'd just broken up.
You were told not to like her.
She'd just broken up with one of my friends, but I thought this is even more reason. Have a listen. I'm not normally... I like listening to the stuff on Not Not Fun, but some of it is just so droney. It's the kind of music you can only really just stare at.
Well, tell us a bit about Not Not Fun. What is Not Not Fun?
It's an experimental label from LA. And now the one of the women who runs it has set up this other label called 100% Silk. And this is what this track's from. It's from a EP called The Sacred and Profane, which is out this week. And first of all, I was like, vocals, they're kind of almost really awful, but there's something about that track I just love. It's this kind of, the disco beat comes in really slowly, and I like to think it's about Gloria Gaynor, because it's called Gloria. I just really like it.
I was hoping it was going to be the Van Morrison, Patti Smith Gloria, but Barney, what did you make of this?
I really liked it, yeah. I mean, I was like sort of combination of dance beats and sort of yearning melancholia, and particularly I like, well, the phrase ghostly disco. Mm-hmm. I don't know where to kind of place it generically, but I liked it very much. It was,
I suppose, disco was always quite melancholy, even when it was at its most upbeat. It always had that undertow, didn't it?
To me, even something like Good Times by Chic has an undertow of melancholy in it, which sort of belies the upbeat message, you know. But anyway, that I thought it was beautiful. Yeah, it was really lovely.
I read a really interesting piece on The Quietus this week about Chic and about that kind of how, you know, people... I think there's a piece in The Guardian today about the new boring, whereas this is kind of a celebration still. And that's what Amanda Bryan, who runs 100% Silk, I interviewed her a couple of weeks ago, and that's what she was talking about. She was talking about this move away from, in America at least, under Bush, they were all just trying to be as weird as possible in that kind of scene. And now there's a lot more beat-based music coming out, people wanting to have a good time because they realise it's not going to get better anytime soon, so they might as well have fun. Although I kind of think it's music, dance music for people who can't dance, because people kind of look pretty strange when listening to that.
All this dance music is getting a bit of a hipster makeover. But it sounds like people who like listen to dance music in their bedrooms almost.
I guess it was like that with stuff like Jungle, though. I was interviewing someone about their collection of rave tapes a few months ago, and they said that his girlfriend always used to ask him, was he having fun? Because he'd stand there looking really miserable, just kind of like moving slightly. And I thought, well, nothing's changed then, because that's sometimes, you know, you go watch a show and that's what you see.
There's an amazing line on it where it says, "Darling, when you touch me," and it sounds like it's going to turn into the Beatles, "I Want to Hold Your Hand." And kind of so much pop does that at the moment. There's these little references and snippets that kind of float in and out throughout a song. And it's just before there's some kind of two-step garage beat, almost like float past. And it's just got that whole thing of feeling really detached and really like it's just barely even conscious, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's a term being thrown around a lot at the moment in, I'm not sure how in love with it I am, but it's post-internet, and it's artists. it's artists.
Post-internet.
It's artists who have grown up with the internet, and so you can access so much music. And I think maybe that's why the music journalism as well, you can spend hours trawling through YouTube and just pick your own way through whatever you want. So I think people have heard a lot of music and it's kind of coming out.
And that, do you think people will look back at kind of 2011 and that will be the set, there will be a definitive sound, because it's so retro, a lot of these tracks, but at the same time they do have their own kind of emotional kind of pull to them.
Yeah, the emotions are all new for the people who are hearing them for the first time. That's why I always think when people, you know, talk about things being retro, I'm like, well, someone's experiencing for the first time now. So,
excellent stuff. Well, that was post-internet sensation Maria Minerva with Gloria. Let's move on now and have a listen to Barney's choice, which is Get Involved by George Soule. That was Muscle Shoals recording artist George Soule with his 1973 track Get Involved. It's appearing on the Fame Studios Story 1961 to 1973. It's a 3-CD collection, hence giving us the excuse to include it in Singles Club. Barney, tell us about George Soule and why you love this record.
Well, it's just a great story. I think it's a great funky record, but it also encapsulates the story of Muscle Shoals, in that this is a white guy singing a kind of politically charged, almost blaxploitation-ish track as a sort of demo.
The song appeared on a Black Panthers, the music of the Black Panthers.
I think it did. Yeah. I think it did. And even more kind of interestingly, I believe that George, who I have met and interviewed, was obliged to appear on something like Soul Train, and this sort of skinny white guy from Mississippi gets up and starts shaking his thing to this Get Involved, lyric, you know. And So I like that story. I think it was probably intended for one of the writers of the song, George Jackson. But I believe that producer Rick Hall probably had in mind somebody like Bobby Womack, you know. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reasons, it wasn't covered by Bobby Womack or Wilson Pickett or anybody else. And it was then Rick liked it so much that he stuck it out as a single. It's not sort of classic Muscle Shoals, deep soul sort of ballads. It's in that sense slightly atypical, but it's late Muscle Shoals, it's 1973. And I think it's just got a great, I mean, he sounds like he's doing a kind of pastiche of Johnny Taylor to me, right, vocally. Right. But it's still, you know, there were these white guys who came out of that neck of the woods.
And do you think a lot of
Alabama, Mississippi, you know, who who really did, because they were so steeped in R&B and soul music, they almost, their voices almost became African-American. Most famously, Eddie Hinton, who I defy anybody to come blind to Eddie Hinton and think that this guy is Caucasian.
Well, I couldn't believe it was a white guy singing, you know, just when hearing the record for the first time. And what's so amazing about it is even if you listen to it on YouTube, that it just sounds so punchy. And so, like, you just will not hear that sound anymore, no matter how hard you try and get it, even if you wanted to get it. It just kind of leaps out at you, and the horns are kind of amazing.
Yeah, I quite agree. It's strange, isn't it? You know, all the sort of retro merchants who try to recreate the feel, the texture of a record like that. It's you can't do it. You can't, because it was of a place and time and has that kind of organic quality.
Sean, what did you make of it?
Yeah, I really liked it. It's the first time I heard it. I'd have a dance to that. It's basically my kind of...
That is basically...
It's my acid test.
That is basically what it all comes down to at the end of the day.
Would I ever dance to that? Yes, I would.
You put your handbag down.
I've got a rucksack. I'll have a dance. Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. When was the first time you heard that track? So it's the first time I heard it.
Oh, gosh, I would have heard it when I was... I wrote a book about Southern Soul many, many moons ago, and I think I heard it around that time. As with Eddie Hinton, I just thought, you're telling me this guy is not African-American, you know, it was just extraordinary. And then I met him. He couldn't have been less African-American.
Yeah, because, like, the pictures of him, he doesn't even look like a white soul musician, really, does
no,
he?
He looks like a sort of scrawny little professor from the University of Mississippi or something. He's a sweet guy.
I wonder what people thought when he first kind of opened his mouth and that came out. It's like, amazing. Well, it's a positive verdict, anyway, for George Soule and Get Involved. Which means it's time to move on to my own entry to this week's Singles Club, which is Holy Ghosts, I Wanted to Tell Her. That was Holy Ghost with a cover of Ministry's 1983 song, I Wanted to Tell Her. And this is my choice. Holy Ghost, they're a pair of New York electro musicians, done lots of remixes, and they're involved with people like DFA and Hot Chip. I don't know too much about them. I'm sure Sean knows more about them than me. But the reason I like them is I just think this is just basically, you know, it's a 1983 song, but they've stayed faithful to it, but they've just made it sound modern, and they've really... as soon as you hear this, you want to put your rucksack down, as Sean said, and dance. And seeing as we're having a bit of a music journo chat, it reminds me of a movement we tried to create during the golden era of Enemy 2005, which was called Slapcore, which involved anyone with a slap bass. I think Hot Chip and Harmar Superstar might have been involved. Surprisingly didn't take off, although the influence is obviously felt today in this. Sean, can you update us any more to do
with that? Yeah, I think that track has got on it as well. Juan McLean, who's releasing on DFA, and also one of LCD Sound System. So it is a real kind of DFA loving. They're doing a lot more now that James Murphy has stopped doing LCD Sound System and kind of releasing.
They put out the Factory Floor.
Factory Floor one, and they've just done the Rapture album as well. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that, although it didn't remind me of the original. It reminded me of Wham, Copacabana. But I think that says more about me than the track, probably. I really love that Wham track. I enjoyed it. Another thing is it's coming out on Green Label Sound, which is the Mountain Dew, the soft drinks label. I'm always a little bit wary when something...
It does make you... It just sounds like you should be quite wary, doesn't it, when something comes out on a soft drink?
Yeah, it's the Fizzy Drinks releasing a song. But they've been doing a lot of releases this year. They did the Star Slinger release, was their last one. And they've done stuff by Waves and Best Coast.
Isn't it Bacardi have been involved with releasing records as well, and all sorts of brands?
Yeah, Cars, Converse, everyone with something to sell.
This is the future in which we now live. Barney, what did you make?
Strange and bewildering new world, isn't it?
This fizzy, Mountain Dew's first release.
I think... I think that I reviewed the original Ministry single in the NME singles right. column when it came out. So it was sort of kind of eerily retro experience for me to hear that. I thought it was okay, but I kind of hear a lot of stuff that transports me back to the early 80s. And it does sound a bit kind of like sort of meta retro pop. It's like something that could have come out on the Z label or Crepuscule or something right. circa 81, 82, 83. And I suppose because I kind of went through that era, I sort of think, well, what really is the point of this? Is it adding a great deal to what was there in the first place? So I kind of like that, the sort of ironic spirit and energy of it, but it didn't transport me.
What about the rest of this 80s revival? Because I think Simon Reynolds has talked about how the 80s revival's gone on longer than the 80s did. Which is, you know, the first time I heard of an 80s revival was kind of late 90s, which was with the likes of Le Rhythm Digital. Then there was Fisher Spooner. Then there was, you know, LCD Sound System. We've even had the indie revival, like the 80s indie revival. It's just endless.
Well, it's like we're sort of caught in a kind of prison of references and allusions. And I mean, to refer back to something Sean said earlier about post-internet, I do sometimes think that the only real hope for salvation in pop is to sort of disengage from the kind of core newcopia of what's available. You know, go and not Bon Iver here, but don't, you know, go and live in a cabin without any internet connection for 6 months and see if you can sort of generate some new language for music. You know, I just think otherwise it is just too much coming. It's so difficult to find a voice in the thickets of all that.
So, well, two thumbs up, one thumb kind of in the middle from Barney for that. And that, I'm afraid, is all we've got time for this week on Music Weekly. Thank you very much to our two guests for coming in. Barney, it's been a pleasure having you.
Been a pleasure to be here.
What have you got coming up in the next foreseeable future?
Well, Rocksback Pages is sponsoring the award mm-hmm. to Nick Kent next week, so I shall look forward to being there with Nick in his moment of glory. I think we were trying to get a luminary like Jimmy Page to present it, and Jimmy will normally turn up for the opening of a crisp packet, but we can't get him for Wednesday, so I'm not sure he'll be presenting it, but we're sponsoring it and honoured to do that.
Will it be one of the cribs? Second best thing.
Next best thing.
That'd be my dream.
It's also goodbye to you, Sian. Thank you very much for coming in.
No worries, anytime.
How was your debut in the pod?
I enjoyed it very much.
Good, that's what we like to hear. Afraid we have no time for emails. You will have a proper presenter back next week in the shape of Alexis Petridis. So make sure to join us then. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.